All right, are you ready to go, Shaw? Should we dive in? I haven't got the mic ready. Nearly knocked the coffee over. That would have been dangerous. Okay, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, here's the thing, too, I want to ask while you're here. Mm-hmm. The tide times, when I see the tide times on the surf report, they're different to the tide times I read on this here by about a half an hour.
Yes.
Does it vary that much around and in the harbour?
That's the lag from the open coast to the wharf, where that one you're looking at.
Okay.
And same with the mat surface one. The mat surface is actually taken at the wharf. And so that's the lag that the tide takes from coming in the entrance. By the time that water level increases, is about a half an hour to 40 minutes.
So what's it like at the back end of the harbour?
It's even further. So the bigger the harbour, and especially if you've got harbours with a small entrance and big basins, big lags and much increase. So if you look at the Manukau Head, say, we might have around 3.8, 4-metre tide there at the heads, and it could be 4.8 up in Onehunga. So you've a metre higher and an hour later.
Okay. That's pretty substantial. That explains it because, so the surf report's all about where the surf is, obviously.
Yes.
And this one here, which is the surfforecast.com site that's giving me the wharf.
Yeah.
And I go for in between. I don't know if you're watching when I did it, but I didn't say the numbers on the page.
All right. So, the surf one is using the World Tide Model probably. So it's out on the open coast.
Yeah.
And so what happens as well is that the tide starts going out on the coast and on the entrance while it's still going in the upper reaches.
Oh, yeah. 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 So it's kind of sloshing around in the bath sort of thing.
Our main channel, our ebb channel, where the tide goes out, is the central one. But then the tide starts coming in as well, and that's on the side. So that's the channel, a small channel that sometimes gets filled in on the Naranui side.
Yeah.
And that's the flood tide, tidal channel. So that's where the water comes in while it's still going out. It's coming in on that one. And then the ebb channel starts to dominate once they catch up.
Because you guys I've got up on on my laptop screen here a picture of showing what's happening with currents and things in the harbour. It's obviously quite complex.
It is.
The other thing that we want to talk about, which is topical right now. Council, I've just heard from council, they are issuing a warning not to collect shellfish or go swimming for the next 3 days because some sewage was pumped out on the high tide due to a technical fault, not the high tide, on the incoming tide yesterday and also this morning. So it took a long time for them to find out, unfortunately.
Mm.
If only they were on the regular notice board, they would have seen it. But so that's just a reminder for people out there that's a notice that's going up and signs are going up this morning, hopefully. But you said when you came in that you guys did some modelling of what happens.
Yeah.
And we should be clear, it's not raw sewage, it's treated sewage.
It is treated sewage, and I think
we won't see any logs in the harbour.
No, I think, it mostly complies, so this was must be over 10 years ago, and there was a summer, which is a bad time because there's people in the water, and we modelled, it was doing it for maybe a week or so every tide on the incoming, and it really does accumulate and come in into this arm here, down into Kaupua.
Yeah.
It hugs to this coast, our southern coast.
Our side, yeah.
Yeah, and weather, it's hard anecdotal, but there was a lot of, I think it was staph infections that summer, this time of year, but there's still kite boarders and people out there, but, there were still bugs in it. I do not recall whether it was pre UV treatment and all that went in there. But that's where it goes though,
and our side unfortunately. Yeah,
yes.
Well, I guess it's pumped in on our side as well, isn't it?
It is. It's not very far out, and it gets entrained by the currents and even the southwest wind because it's hitting the other side.
Yeah.
It does an upwelling on our side as well, so it brings it to the surface. So the wind's going across the water from the south to the north, so it brings the deeper water up on the southern side.
Oh, okay. Mm. It delivers the energy at that point, isn't it?
Yeah, it's turning that water over, so the surface layer's moving towards the northern side of the harbour, so that means the bottom side is coming up on the southern side.
There's like a loop through the water across the harbour.
Yeah, while all the other stuff is going on
as well. Yeah.
Yep.
So you're making it sound like a slow washing machine.
Something like that,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so something we wanted to talk about this morning was, because we're getting erosion in various places around the beaches, and, I mean, we're starting to understand that the beach environment is very changeable. But I wanted to start off with the walls, because a lot of people look at this and go, let's build a concrete wall to stop that erosion. And in the past, maybe we were fairly clear that's what you do, but these days I think we know more, don't we?
Yes, and walls do have their they do have their place.
Yeah,
especially in, you know, you'll see them mostly in a harbour areas and where there's a hard stand that they're being put on. So, you know, where you've got the rock shelves and
yeah.
So you're protecting the land, but they are a land protection structure. On an open coast, and the more exposed you've got, when waves and water interact with those hard structures, they increase and accelerate erosion. So they bounce off it, they cause reflections, and those reflections take sand offshore. Walls, if you're going to put one in on an open coast, it has to cover the whole littoral cell. So if you were thinking about, say, we've got a, we had the lookout down at the Naranui beach there. If you wanted to protect that, you'd really have to put your wall in the whole of Naranui Beach from one end all the way to the harbour entrance, because you'll get end effects as well. So that's, you know, a natural beach. When you get a storm, it wants to erode, drag sand off. That sand forms a nearshore bar that knocks out the wave energy. So it's actually a natural process to slow down erosion.
Oh, okay, right.
So, but if you put a wall in there, that sand can't be pulled offshore to form that natural protection. And what it does, the demand is there's a deficit where the wall is, so the demand is greater on either end, and you get a big erosion scarp known as an end effect. So they are, you know, a last line of defence, say, right at the back, where, you know, like, say, in the Sydney Northern Beaches, they have their walls and esplanades. They're quite different situations, but, you know, if last line of defence or buried seawalls have their place if you've got important infrastructure on exposed coasts, but mostly it's far better to have a natural dune system to allow it to make that natural defence. Then in periods of calm weather, it'll move onshore. And I think as we were talking before, you can get accretion events that occur just as fast as erosion events.
So this is when the sand builds back up.
Yes.
Because we tend to, before we talk to anyone who knows what they're talking about, you tend to get the feeling that it's just going to keep eroding, and there's old maps from in the past showing that the shoreline was much further out, and now it's in close, and where the toilet block down at the kitesurfing beach is in danger of being toppled, and it's just going from bad to worse to worse.
Mm.
But you're not, that's not what you're saying.
No, and let's say that area, we do have, most of New Zealand has aerial photographs from about 1939 to 1941 through to present day. Nowadays, you know, we're getting them, you know, sometimes weekly with the Google satellites and you
weekly
get
updates.
Satellites, yeah. So, but they're, you know, mostly kind of every decade, and so we have the whole set for Raglan. And if you look at that toilet block area and the Marae area there, in 1940 it was more eroded than it is today.
Right.
And along Naranui Beach, where the toilets are still there now, that worst period was 1974. They're only snapshots in time, but at that time the beach had eroded back to the cliff. So,
right.
You know, and I think we've got to within about 12 metres of that. So we got close a little while ago.
Yeah.
But then it recovers. So, and again, I guess that you've got those elephant rocks shots there. They really demonstrate how dynamic it is at the harbour entrance. That area there is incredible.
So if people on the radio or podcast, we're going to put on our Facebook the series of photos that Shaw took of Elephant Rock. And it sometimes, it was only a period of 2 or 3 years. Elephant Rock is over people's heads, and then later on you can't even see it because the sand is built up completely over the top of it. I knew that, you know, I've talked about cycles, these kind of cycles with you before, but I didn't think it would happen so fast.
Yes.
And in fact, there was a real rapid movement over a period of about 3 months, wasn't there?
Yes, we just buried it. It's gone again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, and some of those, and if you look at, you'll see the when we had that erosion a few years back, the bad state at the with Wainui Reserve end, that scarp, because sand on average moves north on our beaches, that erosion scarp moved down the beach, and you can see it coming in one of the photos. Elephant Rock's still buried, but in the distance you can see the rocks platform showing and all the boulders, and in the next photo it's the elephant rocks starting to show again. So
what we need is like a series of photos from the right angle, one taken every day, and then you could actually see it moving like a wave down the beach. Yes. Well, I guess that's what you'd see, wouldn't you? Like a wave.
You would see it, yes, that front coming down, yes, slowly.
Yeah, and a sand wave.
Yep, and it'll be staggering kind of thing, you know, yep. An event pushes it further. And right. There are, you know, it's all over the world now, remote cameras, there's the Argus system, that kind of thing for exactly what you're talking about. So Gold Coast is a great place because there's all the high-rise on the coast, so they have cameras on top of them.
Oh, yes.
They're taking video snips every hour. We have some, we use them to monitor surf breaks as well, so you can see the changing patterns of where waves are breaking, so how the sand's moving. So there's that technology is really good. And then nowadays you can actually use things like machine learning to crunch millions and millions of photos for you, so to get really good trends on what's going on.
As scientists, that's what you guys are doing. I've been, when you guys used to be down on Cliff Street, I remember going in there one day, and your office was very warm because you've got all these high-powered computers going, just crunching data.
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah, they generate a lot of heat.
Turn the heat on.
Yeah, it must be tough in summer. But so walls. Is there anywhere in Raglan you'd put a wall, a sea wall?
I mean, look, there's some areas where they.
Trying to put it in context, how useful a wall actually is.
Well, definitely not on our open coast, on the beaches there. Anywhere that we see that it's very 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 mobile, coming back and forth, like I've talked about from those photos, the activities building, activities or events building out there on the Marae there now.
Yeah.
You know, they're looking at it, and when we've worked on this to Kopua spit. Plan and looking into the process and what's going on, you know, they've chosen to pull it back and move it out of the way. So because you just cause problems, you push the problem to the next part of the coast. So, but there are areas, you know, when we go down towards the wharf, although it's quite exposed, so you can get quite big waves when the wind's coming screaming straight through the harbour entrance.
Yeah.
But they're on rock platforms, so you're not actually doing a hell of a lot of damage to your natural coastal system.
Yeah.
They are there to protect the land, so which they do quite well. The main, more exposed, the rule of thumb, more exposed and more variable the site is, the less likely you want to be putting a wall in.
Less likely, because that's getting high energy delivered at that point.
High energy, and especially if it's a sandy kind of shoreline. Because it has those natural processes built in, and you're cutting them off and actually exacerbating or accelerating erosion by putting those hard structures where you've got a soft beach.
Yeah, and I've seen photos. I don't know if it was photos that you had or photos that Stacey had at Science Night of an open coast, which obviously at one point been a beautiful beach and was just a seawall or rocks, and it's just like, well, you actually lose your beach in the end, don't you? You don't have a beach.
Yes, exactly, and it makes it very hard. Once the waves are regularly interacting with a hard structure, whether it's a tip rock revetment or a wall, it's very hard for the sand to get back. You're getting, even on a, you know, talk about that, tipping rocks is better because it dissipates energy.
Yep.
Even on a small scale, off each rock you're getting reflection happening. It's far steeper than a natural beach, and it's hard. So it's very hard if it starts to interact on a daily basis for the beach to reform itself.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so that's hopefully... So we just need to remember, and I guess we didn't remember because you said 1974 was the last time it was really eroded, right? Around on the beach back to the hillside.
Back to the hillside.
So since then, we built a surf tower unwittingly. And now we've had to remove it. So
yes.
Will we remember? Will we, in 30 years' time, are we going to be removing a surf tower again down there, do you reckon?
I don't think we will because, it becomes a pretty substantial part of our work these days that all around the country, all around the world, because of sea level rise, is much more thorough investigations go in. We have to do coastal hazard assessments before you do that. So, and it hasn't been that long that you've really focused on and looking at coastal change as part of your before you do any development on the coast.
Yeah.
So, you know, all the councils around the country, they don't want to inherit the big mistakes in 100 years' time. So now our planning horizons for new structures in coastal areas, we look at 2130 at the moment, and I'm sure that's jumping. Our sea level rise projections have gone from about 0.59 of a metre probably a little over 10 years ago. In 100 years, we were looking at 0.59, so a couple of feet of sea level.
Yeah.
Now we're using 1.7 plus your vertical land movement. So most of New Zealand's going down. So
we're going down on this coast?
We're going
this
part down. I think we're going down about 2 or 3 millimetres a year, right here where we are. Some parts, the middle of the country, some parts around Wellington are 9 or 10 millimetres, so faster than sea levels moving at the moment.
Well, Wellington's a pretty active place when it comes to earthquakes and things. So.
It is, and the two plates are dragging each other down.
So this is something people may not be that familiar with, but all parts of the world everywhere are going up or down. Or maybe there's some that are static, but...
Most, but some aren't. So, like, say, somewhere like Fiji, which is just on a volcanic platform out there, it's not moving anywhere.
Yeah.
Not at those kind of rates, anyway.
But where we are, where there's two plates colliding,
yes.
There's a lot of activity. So we've got to account for that.
Yes.
So, yeah, so trying to protect Papahua, the reserve, where the airport is, the campground, soccer fields, long term, we're not going to be able to, are we? Unless we want to build some serious seawalls.
Start, you know, it's not happening tomorrow. You know, looking at this picture in front of us, we know that whole area is going to, you know, in 100 years' time, in a storm surge event, the whole area is underwater. But it's looking on a longer scale. I think it's a good example, I think, is Pāua Nui. And then it's in terms of, say, an example is something that you could think about on somewhere like the Spit, and that's they battled erosion in the central area there, and there's an airstrip that goes down the middle. If you're familiar with that area there, Esplanade Reserve that had been clay capped, like a lot of Te Kopua and the airfield there.
Yeah.
They scraped all the clay away, piled all the sand up, and replanted it naturally. So, you know, there's re-establishing natural dunes that used to be that whole spit. You know, slowly doing it. Whether you did it on the seaward side, it is as we've shown in that report how it is very dynamic and it moves all the time. But part of the, you know, it makes it. More vulnerable and more dynamic, so to speak, is when you don't have the natural systems there. So lots of it doesn't have the natural dune systems. And you look at the work of Coast Care, especially on that, on the end where the domain is,
with
all the plants in there, it's far more robust when, you know, that gets, as I said, some substantial waves come through the harbour entrance and it gets really eroded sometimes, but the spin effects is still there and the penile, and it recovers very well.
Because those plants are like designed by God to sand will stay with us, you know, collect sand, aren't they?
That's one way
of describing it anyway.
Yeah, they're called halophytes, so they are salt tolerant. So if you got most of our terrestrial grasses and vines and things, if they're hanging there and the salt water comes over them just once, they'll all die.
Yeah.
It won't hurt those plants. They are the natural species that were all around our coasts, and unfortunately the rabbits and the goats and the cows and the sheep grazed on them over the, you know, since 150 years or so, or since we introduced them all, and they're a favourite food. I think you still can see the hares out there these days.
Hares on the soccer fields. When I was involved with the soccer club, that was an issue.
Yes, so they love the stuff. But the success stories where Spinifex and Pinau have been planted on our coast, there's so many of them, especially on our east coast.
One thing about the whole from the airfield, in fact, almost from the Corkery centre down, that's a sand spit, basically.
Yes.
With sea level rise, would that just keep building up? Or is there something that underpins the sand spit?
I'm not actually sure. We do have hard substrate under it at the entrance. Yeah. Otherwise, that would work, meander around. So we've got hard structure, and we see that at the moment, actually. We were in a very erosive phase. There's work by Greg Jenks and Willem de Long that have looked at, once you have the natural system in there, you can build it much faster than sea level will rise. So looking at if we re-establish all the plants along there, get rid of the clay. You know, there's a lot of sand that if you're out there on a day like today, especially when it isn't raining, the amount of sand, windblown sand, and that is for years that is not, wasn't accounted for in coastal management, how much sand disappears due to the wind or gets moved around. And so having those types of plants in there, the blades stand up, the sand hits it and they fall down and it gradually builds up.
So back in the day before we did developed that land, when it just was a series of, I've seen old photos and it was just sand hills up and down, up and down, and plants and everywhere, that would have kept building up. But now, do we collect sand on the airport? Like, it's mown grass, so we're probably not collecting a lot of sand.
Not really. And you can see where the parts of it are eroding. You can see the soil cap on top of it, and then underneath that you've got the relic old sand. So as we come out to the open coast, it's quite different. So like you were talking about the surf and the Raglan points, you know, there's a lot of evidence, and even evidence of, you know, we had a big storm in 99 that threw a lot of those kind of boulder kind of structures. They will survive a long, long time in sea level rise, and that's because a big event comes through. There's the energy in the wave to toss those boulders up, but it can't drag them back down like small grains of sand. So you build up and up. As the sea comes up, as sea level rises, they will continue to build up.
So that area could have been here through quite a bit of sea level rise over the thousands of millennium, I guess.
Potentially
just building itself up, and then we've come along and we've made everything flat and mown it, and now it can't build up?
Yep. So it's a worldwide problem. So the sea level's always gone up and down. In the last 6,000 years, since the last big jump in sea level rise, it moved from about 30 metres deep to what it is today. So it's got rose 30 metres as an interglacial, as the ice melted more.
Yep.
It's been one of the most stable times for sea level in a long, long time. It's only a blink in geological time, but that's really, when we look at it, some of our oldest civilizations and oldest cities and towns are only 5,500 years ago old. So we have developed our coast in all over the world in a period of very stable sea level, and now there's with the increased CO2 at the moment, because the average temperatures rise than on the planet, the main thing that's driving sea level rise is just thermal expansion off the water. So it's just expanding, and
water doesn't really expand that much, but I guess there's a lot of it
on a global scale. I think it's the first half metre or metre of sea level rise will be for thermal expansion.
Wow. That's new information that I wasn't aware of. Yeah, okay. Now let's talk about... Now we've just been talking about how a lot of the erosion and accretion of sand on the beach is normal. It comes and goes and cycles. But there's one area where there's a little bit different story, which is just along from the footbridge toward where the boat ramp is, that area there. 10 years ago, we replaced, when I say we, the council, replaced the footbridge, and there was, the old footbridge had something that was effectively acting like a groin.
Yes.
And I know I've seen emails, you were trying to warn regional council at the time that might change things, because what's the difference, like that's acting as a groin, so it's a physical impediment. What's the distance between that used to be, from where that used to be back now, to where there was really isn't a groin, but there's something solid.
Yeah, so the prior bridge, and you can still at low tide, you can see, looking back towards the boat ramp, you can see an old concrete-filled geotextile bag. That was where the abutment of the bridge was. So there was a concrete pathway all the way to the grass.
Yeah.
And I think it was about 23 metres long. When the new bridge came in, they removed that and put it's a different area now. It's a different angle. So they did it beside it. But they put the bridge all the way nearly to the grass. So that concrete footpath that came up to where the footbridge used to start acted as a groin, and it was only a low profile groin, but in coastal engineering, a way to stabilize a spit like that is a terminal groin. To do that, we've got hard structures, there's rock, so it's a pretty stable spit, but over the years, the 60 years or so that was there, it's a very benign environment, but it's slowly built and held sand there. Once that was gone, we were slowly seeing the chronic loss of sand,
except it feels like it's speeding up at one point at the moment.
It potentially is because it'll get to a stage, it'll hit a threshold where it's a bit like when I was talking about the hard structures. If your hard structures interacting with waves on a daily basis, your erosion's happening. It's happening all the time. Once the sand's getting up onto that, once the water's getting up onto what used to be our flat platform beach,
yeah,
more often it's taking more away. And that, it was a while ago that I walked along there with... It was Malibu Hamilton.
Yes,
and we actually timed it by fortune that it was a very high tide, but a northwest wind blowing, and that little northwest wind with a thin layer of water, that was enough to make little waves to suspend the sand, and the current was taking it away. So the more often, so once you get to that period where it's getting wet all the time, it'll move faster. So.
Do you feel, I want to ask, this is a political question, do you feel frustrated? Because I've seen the copies of these emails. For 10 years you've been trying to get people, and in fact you disagreed with an expert that was involved with the construction of the bridge who said there would be no change, didn't you?
Yes, and that was, it was unfortunate. It was going through that resource consent phase, and actually the guy at the council got sick and died suddenly, and so it kind of went
the person you were dealing with.
With the person we were dealing with, and he was actually very good at the council, Vernon Pickett, it kind of slipped under the radar, and then I was disagreeing, saying, you're basically changing the you had the heart, we've got the wall on one side on our town side,
oh, from the jetty,
and then you had this other hard structure, you take that away, you're changing the cross-sectional area, you're going to lose the sand, and it's slow, and that's one of the things, when it's slow like that, people forget, and it just slowly happens. It's like the death by a thousand cuts kind of thing. So that's why I was trying to get onto it before, because we put it as it's already going now, and we can put something back in there to hold it, but it'll take a little while again to gradually build up again.
Mm. And I know so that was the regional council then, that they do the resource consent, but you're also trying to get district council to set up some measures.
Monitoring,
but that never happened either.
I think a lot of it is people change at the council. So I walked over it with a couple of the guys from Parks, I think it was, and actually sent them here, put your monitoring lines in here, and let's monitor it every month or 3 months to get an idea and just prove what's going on, because we've got aerial photographs and that kind of thing, but this is real data, we can show what's going on, but no, it still hasn't happened. So it is a bit of a issue, because it's a iconic little beach there, especially on this summer we've got coming. We've got a El Nino summer, so you're going to have southwesterlies on Naranui every day, and it's that summer where it's quite cold around that side, and coming into town there, and you see it on a hot summer, how well utilised that is. It's an important asset for the town. So,
I've seen like those maps you're talking about where we've got the aerial photographs since 39 or 40, sometime around then.
Yes.
There was around 1940, the shoreline actually cut through where the road currently is, down near that first set of toilet blocks as you come up to the soccer fields. And that's actually where it's cut. Like, now you can see erosion because it's cutting in. Like, it's like an army's making a movement in through the front line of the enemy. And it's kind of like that. Maybe I shouldn't do it in terms of a battle, but... it's significant and is getting people's attention now.
It is.
But yep, what? So what's the? Well. Yeah. What's regional council always says? Because I've talked to regional council and they said the first thing we always do is planting. But I would say to them that this is a different situation because a groin's been removed. What do you think the solution is?
I think, you know, re-establishing what was there, and you know, when we look at resource consents, you know, the president said in past legal battles, you take it from what it is now to what your impacts are going to be. So if it had gone through the process properly, there's no way that would have been taken out. So, and then the other aspect, and I think Stacey at Coast Care would agree that it's very hard to put implants in an eroded environment.
In fact, she's really clear about that. That's not when you plant. You wait till it's not eroding.
You wait till it's not eroding. Yeah. So the first stage here, I mean, you know, I understand what the regional council is saying. We always put in plants because they're what's missing from our natural system. But in this case, it's already a modified environment. You know, we've got boat ramps, footbridges, walls on one side, all sorts of infrastructure in there.
Yeah.
That just putting that back in, and it wouldn't be in a very expensive thing, and it should still be low profile until the first pile of the bridge there.
Yeah.
Then once you've re-established that, then you could start establishing your planting.
Yeah, and then we would see it gradually build up again over a couple of decades or something like
that. Yes, it's very benign, and when you look at it, you know, through the time series, it built up very, very slowly. You know, by the time you get round there, and because of all the stabilisation of the grass and on the football fields and the airfield, there isn't that windblown sand coming in there, so there's not a big source like there used to be, so it takes a long time.
Is there an argument for deliver? Well, we don't need to deliver some sand, we just need to stop it before it starts digging out the pahutukawas, basically.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, so
are those pahutukawas in danger? How do they cope with seawater?
They don't mind seawater, but they will fall just like any other.
They'll fall over if there's no ground under them, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all this from between the end of the main road here and James Street on Cliff Street, and where the James Street little park out turnout is there, all those, the majority of the pahutukawas are in danger there. They're hanging in the air. They get their feet wet on the big spring tides or when we've had a persistent nor'westerly and we've got high water levels in the harbour. So, yeah, but they the salt water doesn't hurt them, but the lack of somewhere to have their roots does.
Didn't you have a place down on Cliff Street?
Yes.
Do you regret buying there? I want to know, what's your professional opinion on your purchase?
The geology actually changes quite significantly between, so it's that first part from Orchard down to James Street is the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
A lot of softer clays and little pockets that are getting worn out.
Yeah.
Once you get past and we're further down, it's more sandstone and the cliff, as it erodes, it drops actual big slabs of sandstone and it's a much slower process. So no, it's that first part that you know, and
that's vulnerable.
Yes, where that little they've made it a bit harder. You know, it was like stones there before. They've made it harder now. It's that nice, people use it a lot. It's the James Street little park out there where you're first going in there, and I sometimes see cars or camper vans parked on that side. They're in midair over there. They don't know, and it's undermined there quite substantially. And
well, good luck, everybody. Yeah, so what was the other thing I was going to say? So, yeah, I mean, like the future for Raglan, I guess there's no hurry. There's been times when I've thought, heck, we're like, it's all happening now. Like the airfield's been eroded from both sides. You know, this is climate change happening to us now. But can you give us a perspective on that? Like how many of these things are, like sea level rise is so slow, and we have extreme events, like how do we work through that and work out whether this is a sign of sea level rise and climate change or whether it's just something that would have happened anyway?
Yeah, it is hard, and especially where you've modified the environment. So that, you know, our whole spit is basically a modified environment. It's not natural anymore.
Yeah.
I think, it is very slow. It's our future generations or our children and their children that will inherit what's going on. You know, there's no doubt sea level rise is happening, and so we have, I think it's in the Netherlands back to the 15th century. We've been measuring sea levels. In New Zealand, we're back into the late 19th century. We have ports of Auckland. I think there was four gauges around the country at that time. So we know it's going up. Whether you want to believe it's because of climate change or not, doesn't matter. It's going up.
And
we know it's accelerating as well from the readings. So, and that's what the planning tools are now. That's one of the things to help us do deal with it. So in 2017, the Ministry of Environment brought out the guidance to local government on coastal hazards and sea level rise, climate change. And they developed, which is shown to be very successful. It's a thing that we've applied for a few decades now, but it is really looking at going into a place like, and it'll happen all over the country. Hawke's Bay, I think, is one of the first big ones. It's looking at dynamic adaptive planning pathways. So what we're doing is saying we know the sea's rising. How do we look at our whole coast and how are we going to manage it as things go on? And so we look, and it's part of what we did for the Te Kopo Spit. You know, I guess that forms a basis to develop your DAP, D-A-P-P.
Yes.
And so you get to a stage, and rather, and we're going more now away from, you know, while I say in 100 years' time or to 2030, we're looking at 1.7 metres of sea level on a greenfields development to use it for planning. We don't use the years. We use triggers. We say, well, when the erosion gets back to here or when this marker pole falls in the sea, then we do this. And we have choices what we want to do. But the main and the most important thing to do is to bring the community along. So the centre of all that decision-making is the community. What's important to the community on their coast? What are the real things they value? What are the real things we want to see protected? Or, you know, do you, you know, because you can get in there and do all your heavy armouring and all that, although it's very hard now. It's the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement 2010 is against hard structures, so it's especially in exposed places. But yeah, it's really looking at it and planning for it, and it gives people and communities a much bigger, better peace of mind. I was over on the Sunshine Coast a couple of months back at the Australasian Coast and Ports Conference, and there was a talk on a little township just north of Christchurch and how they'd developed it there. They're actually, even now, they're in vulnerable to flooding. They can get their whole township, but they realise, you know, that we do have to retreat. It's going to be inevitable worldwide, and it's lots of places in New Zealand, but it's not happening now. Let's make a plan. It gives people a lot more confidence, understanding of what's going on. Similar things we do around the Pacific Islands, we're actually looking at not that 100-year plan horizon, just the next 20 to 30 years, call it buying time, and managed advance. We're trying to advance the shoreline using usually nature-based or hybrid solutions that mix together soft approaches and hard engineering approaches to say you're so vulnerable, you're a meter above high tide, you get flooded already, but we want to make it more robust so that over those coming decades, you can look at managed retreat. Managed retreat sounds easy. It's very complex.
Not from an atoll. I lived in the Pacific, and I've lived on atolls, like in Tokelau when I was a kid, and the highest point in that entire country is 5 metres above sea level, and most of it is not even near that.
No, one or two.
But the thing with atolls is they are built up, like they are built up by natural living creatures.
Yes.
Can they keep up with the pace of sea level rise?
Professor Paul Kench from Auckland University has looked into this for decades, and it's interesting. There's some indication that where there's no humans,
they might be all right.
They're all right, and they keep up. And it's also shown that there's different events. So an event like a tsunami, they often don't cause a lot on our tiny atolls because they're coming out of very deep water, so the tsunami wave doesn't get a chance to shoal, but it will push a lot of debris from the edge of the reef shelf up on and onto the land, all of a sudden you've got a big build-up. Tropical cyclones do the same. Up in northern Fiji, Cyclone Winston, when it came through, it made Winston Island on the southern side of Garmia Island. So it's just all the debris and that. It had never been there before, and it's maintained, it's stayed there. So feedback process and all that kind of working. But there is indication, though, that where humans are, and especially on the smaller atolls, because they use the sand to build the building, unfortunately a lot of places have taken the sand away.
There's not actually a lot of sand either. Not the places I've been anyway.
No,
they don't have beaches. Like, we have a beach at Wainui, which is low tide, you can be like 100 meters sometimes,
yes,
down to the water. Well, some beaches like that, it's like a few meters in the
Well, that's another thing we work on, like in our temperate regions, where all the coastal engineering's come from, the system's so different. Our sand comes mostly from the land. It gets washed out of the rivers.
Yeah.
There's some erosion of cliffs and that kind of thing. And then the beach goes down and so it goes down fairly steeply. It'll hit a depth of closure. It might be, 8 meters or so. And then it'll keep going down to an outer depth of closure, and then slowly all the way down to the edge of the continental shelf, about 200 meters away. But in a coral island situation, the sand is biogenic. The vast majority of that sand is made by animals grazing on the reef. So it's as well as your calcaric kind of seaweeds like halimeda, they'll break off, wash up, bleach out. And for example, though, like a reef grazing fish, like a parrot fish, an adult one about 40 centimeters long, that will generate about a half cubic meter sand a year by grazing on the reef and pooping it out again.
Really?
So quite often we come and we've
got
the
beach is actually fish poo.
Yes, and urchin poo, they're grazing on it too. A portion of it is where it gets broken off in stormy, but that takes a long time to break down in comparison. So we go to sites and they've got an erosion problem, and actually you've got a reef problem. Your reef, you don't see any grazing species. You've got when your grazing species go, you also run the risk of getting seaweeds coming in, and once the seaweeds come in, you've lost your source of sand, your sand engine's broken. So part of a restoration process is developing small marine reserves, no-take reserves, so that you get that sand engine coming back to these areas.
Now, I'd written down a note back earlier about sewage pipes. Why did I write that down? There was something. I know what it is. So yeah, you were talking about planning for sea level rise. A lot of our sewage system, the pipes are actually running round at around the high tide level in our community, and that's something. When we had a bit of a crisis of sewage going into the harbour a few years ago, it was happening really regularly. We did look at one of the options put to the community was what it was discussed anyway about whether we'd have to replace that whole network. No one was ready to spend that kind of money yet, and they can make the access lids and everything. They can make them all waterproof down there, but at some point, I guess having our sewer pipes underwater doesn't seem like a smart move.
Especially if
you're below water level.
Yes, and this is a problem all around the country, all around the world. Stormwater systems too. You can't get rid of your stormwater if the sea level is coming in the pipe and backing it up and backing it up. So
yeah,
all over the place like Petone and Wellington, and all over the country, all over the world, you'd rather not be discharging your sewage into the sea. Land-based disposal would be better. Hard, though. You need the right types of soil and big areas.
Well, they're working on it, and they found a potential place for it. Yep. We're getting a bit of NIMBY activity around it. Not in my backyard.
Sure.
And even then, they would still have to allow to put it into the sea when we get like heavy storms and heavy rainfall. I think they know that there will always be times when they can't rely on it.
The stormwater and the sewage mixed together. Yeah.
Mm. Hey, and there's one thing I want to ask about. I know there's a lot of controversy around the breakwall at Manu Bay. There was just a question I wanted to ask about the rules around how that's designed in a surf. There's a protected surf break there?
Yes.
Is that a regional or national level surf break protection on there?
It's national. It's one of New Zealand's 17 nationally significant surf breaks.
Right. So the old wall was a wall, and the waves reflect it off it, and the new wall is a like a ramp, I guess you could say, for want of a better description.
Mm.
Is that a requirement in that area to do it that way?
The because requirement it, because it's is to protected. Not have an adverse effect. If you're doing anything, the requirement is to not have any adverse effect on the wave, water quality wave, and access to the wave.
Okay, so but like I'm involved in reporting all the controversy going on, and
yes.
and the fishing club's been lawyers to the council, and you know all that kind of thing's been going on in the background, and I don't want to get into the controversy, but the thing I just wanted to understand that that's like a requirement. We can't go back to having a wall that reflects the wave.
No. And at the moment, we're involved with Tonkin and Taylor as well, just looking at options. And our involvement is modelling them and looking at things like reflections. So some of the options that have come up have caused reflections, so they're straight off the table.
Right, okay.
Yeah. If anything, it's got to improve things, but, you know, there's no can't have an impact on the surfing wave.
Yeah, and we probably can't have boulders appearing on the boat ramp either.
No, it's a very complex thing, you know, because it's historic and there's downstream impacts as well of erosion, so there's a whole lot of things to address. And in some ways, the controversy over the breakwater is probably going to help with that to manage what's going on there better.
Okay, it will actually do be some learnings and some resolution in the end.
Yes, I think so. And you know, it's a complex environment, and it's a complex human environment as well. There's so many different stakeholders involved in that area.
Yeah, and I know at the current solution, which is probably a temporary solution, has been to get rid of the boulders from beside the wall so that the waves can't push them over. And you can see when you look at there's drone photos and even the surf cam. You can see it at certain tides. It's really clear where they've pulled them out. Well, that I presume that's going to fill in, the boulders will fill back in there again eventually.
Yes, they will. I mean, when it's a breakwater on a coast where you know the boulders move. They only move from you know outside from out at the point all the way towards the beach. They're only really going that direction. We don't get waves big enough generated by wind from the northeast to push them in the other direction.
Push them the other way, yeah.
So they only go in one direction. So you're capturing them, and they were destined to go down the coast. And so part of management plan, and it's already been looked at, is transferring them over to the other side.
Right, so you don't have to pick them up and take them away.
No, you should never take them away. You know, and that's, again, that this is been a big issue with ports all around the world where you've got a breakwater port, the sand fills in their fairway channel and they dump it off in deep water, and therefore all your beaches on the other side of that all start to erode. So nowadays we look at where we can put that sand so it feeds back into the system and you're having a much less impact on it.
Yeah, okay, all right. Well, look, folks, we've been talking to Shaw Mead from eCoast, and the central takeaway, the thing I wanted people to remember is We people are saying, let's put a wall up to stop the sand eroding, and you're saying that that's not a fantastic solution, and in some places not a solution at all.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the thing. We don't want to spend money on walls and this end up with no beach or other
problems.
They are
land protection structures, and they have their place, but very rarely on an open coast or an exposed area, and not in a sandy area, unless it's a backstop wall like I talked about where you have valuable assets behind it and that it's only happening now and again and it's not interacting all the time.
Yeah, and we will put some images up on our Facebook for people to check out as well that just show how much the cycle of sand moving around at beaches is quite phenomenal, really.
Mm.
Yeah. All right, thanks for coming in, Shaw.